What did you actually achieve by getting out?
Freedom.
For yourselves?
Yes. Freedom to continue. And perhaps to just simply draw attention to a couple of anomalies.
But did it change anything?
Who says anything changes anything? Come on. This, you know,
but
life
is
not...
I won't say if you had stayed there and kept your nose clean, but maybe if you had been a bit more adroit in the way you handled yourself,
I'm sure you could have ended up
as Director General.
I wouldn't have been remotely any use as Director General.
Really?
I wouldn't, really. Not at all.
Hello again and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today has been described as a trailblazer of Irish media and the arts. Lelia Doolan has enjoyed an extraordinary professional life spanning television, film, theatre and environmental activism. She began her career at Telefi Sharon, where she became a pioneering and occasionally a controversial figure in Irish television. Following her departure from the national broadcaster, she has worn many hats, including writer, filmmaker, theatre director and lecturer. Her work has included directing the popular rural drama on RTE The Reardons and founding the Galway Film Fla. She was also the first woman artistic director of the Abbey Theatre. Joining us in your adopted home of Galway, Lelia Doolan, you're welcome to the Insights podcast.
Thanks very much, Sean. It's nice to be here with you.
I could have listed a lot more in your CV, wide and varied and active over a long number of years. But I was fascinated by something you said, almost by way of an aside, during a forum chaired or organised by President Higgins. You said your father had known Michael Collins. He shared an office with him in London.
Yeah, they sat opposite to one another in the post office in London. My dad was a young, bright country child of 16, and he did the civil service examination, which was British-wide at that time. And consequently, he joined the civil service. I wouldn't say that himself and Michael Collins did anything more than sit opposite to one another and chat over whatever the devil they chatted about, because Dad, he kept a diary during that period. You wouldn't have known that there was anything in the world except going for walks with girls called Bunty and Babs and those kind of things. And that there was a world war going on. Not at all. Anyway, he came back to Cork when the state occurred and he was repatriated with a lot of other Irish civil servants.
And what did he think of Collins? Did he admire Collins?
He never uttered about Collins, but my mother loved Collins, like many of the ladies, I suppose, in the country generally. She was a Clare woman. He was a Clare man. They were both from Clare. And she went on an errand for Collins, actually, from Cork. She was going on her holidays. And the man who was with them going on board the boat, which was going round to Dublin and then on, he was taken. And he had said to her beforehand, if I'm taken, here is the message you're to bring to Collins, which she did. And we have a letter in the files of the family, kept by Jim, my brother, from Collins to Mother, saying, Dear Miss Maloney, come and see me in Portobello Barracks tomorrow morning. She delivered a message and she survived.
What about your own politics? I mean, were you a nationalist? Are you a nationalist?
No, I am not a nationalist. I was a nothing, I'd say, for a long time. I was a kind of a tolerant internationalist. I would have been a bit of a socialist, if anything. And certainly working in television, you would inevitably, I think, be drawn in that direction, simply because of the mix of people, because of the snobbish attitude of some, the kind of hierarchy that occurred, the absence of women who were there in positions of obvious power. But of course, it was the women who ran RTE in those days.
And what was it like? Was it a period of ferment in that first decade of RTE? I mean, you were involved in drama, I think lighter entertainment. You were in at the start of the Reardons, and then there was 7 days. So it seems like you had a lot of opportunities.
Oh, yes. Well, there was a kind of a brigand controller of programmes in Gunnar Rugheimer. And he kept on having new ideas. You know, sometimes it would be the station would have a different topic for every night. And of course, he had this mad idea that we would broadcast every evening at whatever time it was, just before tea, 6 o'clock, I suppose. In those days, Irish people had their dinner in the middle of the day and they had their tea at 6 o'clock in the evening. He decided that we would have a live broadcast from Shinrone every evening at 6 o'clock. And this meant a camera was placed in the middle of Shinrone and people came and went. Sometimes they talked, sometimes they didn't, sometimes they found somebody to interview. And it was, you know, an amazing kind of take on what you could do with mobile camera units.
You better remind people about where Shinrone is.
It's in Tipperary, of course. Where else?
And how long did that last?
I think it lasted a year. And then there were, as I say, different topics on different nights. Agriculture one night, maybe sport another night. I cannot remember precisely. Mm-hmm. We set it out in the book that we wrote afterwards when we had left television, called Sit Down and Be Counted. And I think you'll find a list of each night's events.
You were one of three producers who resigned from RTE in 1969, I think it was, and then afterwards you published that book with Jack Dowling and Bob Quinn.
Yeah.
What was all that about?
It was about the mixture of middle-class ideas about what Ireland should be as against what it actually was. Jack Dowling's programme, Home Truths, had been taken off the air because Helena Rubinstein, the advertising, was not pleased that a programme which suggested to women that they could use things on their faces or on their hands.
And there was a lot about nail varnish remover.
Yeah,
I think you advised viewers that if they mixed acetone and water, I think 15% to 70, I might have the figures wrong, that would be sure. And then the sellers of nail varnish removal, they got into a tizzy about it.
Well, I don't know who got into a tizzy, but in any event, the advertising department, which in effect had big influence on programming in the mind of the director general, said, we don't like this. And off the air came the program. But the real crisis, I think, occurred when there was a move by management to take 7 days, which had been a current affairs program, and looked analytically at what was going on in the political world, and move it into the newsroom. And we regarded that as a bad move because really news is about reporting what's going on and current affairs is about analysing.
But I was wondering, though, about things like there was a proposal to send a crew to Vietnam.
Oh, well, that was really Moorish. For some reason, this has been set down in the annals as part of my doing. Moorish McGonagall, who really ran the other public affairs programme, which was the local and international news seen from a local point of view, whereas we ran a kind of international. 7 days was intended to be more international. And it was Murish who came up with the idea, and he got as far as Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was sent back. He was told to come back, and they were told that they could describe what went on with their pens.
Yeah, I mean, the word was the Taoiseach believed that the best interest of the nation would not be served by sending a news team to Vietnam.
Ah, listen. He was the one, Lamassu, who said it was an instrument of public policy, RTE, which I mean was a bit of a red rag to a bull.
Yeah, but I mean, you were warned, I think, and this was the letter from Hardiman about a public campaign of dissent. And you felt you couldn't really kind of toe the line, was it? Was that your problem? You felt you should be allowed to do what you want?
Not at all. Of course it wasn't. I wanted to do what public service broadcasting was set up to do, which was to make programmes in the public interest and not to be influenced, if possible, by either politicians or commerce, which were the two main intervailing forces that work their way through systems and, you know, are hierarchical, middle class, snobbish, nationalistic, generally, you know, and not very socialist. I would say that RTE was probably more inclined to serve middle class Ireland than any of the marginalised peoples.
And your views now about RTE, over half a century on from your departure, this is a very general kind of a question. I mean, do you think it has served the country well?
In general, I do think it has probably, yes, attempted to do that. But I don't think it has a chance when commerce is really part of its remit. And I don't believe it's able, therefore, to overcome the overweening influence, perhaps, of game shows and commercial attractiveness. Yeah. I always felt, in fact, though, that things like the Reardons and Talk Row, and nowadays perhaps Fair City, probably say more about the politics of the country and what is actually going on than do any of the so-called political and public affairs programmes. And that was the case in the old days as well, where the Late Late Show was really the Geiger counter of national feeling and interest. You know, I mean, it was a programme that was, and up until a while ago, well, quite a while ago, let's say, it was a programme that, to my mind, far outstripped much of the public affairs broadcasting that went on in RTE.
And there was that kind of open discussion about the Late Late Show. I mean, maybe people have looked back at the early years through rose-tinted glasses, but I mean, you know, it was able to host a one-hour discussion involving your good self and your two co-producers who resigned, Bob and Jack, with Michael Garvey, from who was the controller of programmes.
Yes, the Late Late Show was a place for that kind of discussion where you could expect to have controversy and you could expect to have opinionated people like we were. We were opinionated people. I mean,
but you had this view that there should be no advertising.
Yes.
I mean, that would have been an ideal world. That was a kind of a utopia. But
the BBC has managed to do it for a long time.
Yeah, but even more, you could say, at the beck and call, or at the mercy, I should say, of the mandarins of the Treasury. Because if their licence fee gets squeezed, well, they've no alternative.
That's
by way
true.
Of sponsorship or advertising.
Go to the people then and say to the people, do you want us or do you not want us? And will you give us a few more shillings?
You were somebody who was seen as a trailblazer. Now, I know you say you didn't ever have a career, but there used to be a phrase by some of the guys in middle management, more on the technical side, whatever you do, never threaten to leave. You've always threatened to stay. And I think that might have been a view that kind of was generated or inspired by what you and the others did. I mean, what did you actually achieve by getting out?
Freedom.
For yourselves?
Yes. Freedom to continue and perhaps to just simply draw attention to a couple of anomalies.
But did it change anything?
Who says anything changes anything? Come on. This, you know,
but if
life
you,
is
if
not...
You, I won't say if you had stayed there and kept your nose clean, but maybe if you had been a bit more adroit in the way you handled yourself,
I'm sure you could have ended up
as Director General.
I wouldn't have been remotely any use as Director General.
Really?
I wouldn't really. Not at all. Well, the job would have been interesting. The work would have been interesting. But I wouldn't take that job, would you? Would you?
No, but it's great that somebody is willing to take it on with all the... With all the challenges that it presents and all of the snipers that are there, some of them more open than others, and forever trying, certainly in the last 30 or 40 years, to do more with less by way of resources.
Snipers will always be with us. And the trouble is that an awful lot of life nowadays costs more because the people are using less imagination. But let's not go on talking about broadcasting, because honestly, in the end of all, it's one piece of the trivia of life. And we are now engaged in a whole lot of other things. The commodification of the world, which was one of the things we tried to draw some attention to in those days. The breaking up, this propriety, the application forms that farmers have to fill in on every aspect of their lives. I mean, there is a kind of industrialization of human life that's going on unbeknownst, and technologization, if that is a word, I don't know, that is counter to human nature. You know, we are imaginative creatures. We are artistic people. This is the way the world is.
Speaking of artistic people, you became artistic director of the Abbey in the early 70s after you left RTÉ. What was that like?
Dreadful in many ways and wonderful in others. I felt that the company had been intimidated in a way for a very long time, and they were lacking in self-respect to a great extent. And, you know, I tried, insofar as I was able, with John Slemon, who was the manager, the two of us kind of together, tried to insert back into the mix a sense of the importance of the work, a sense of writers being at the heart of the work. And I had ideas for productions and things of that kind. I had a very sad beginning because I produced St. Joan. Unfortunately, it was not a success, number one. But at the same time, there was a bombing campaign in the centre of Dublin in that year, in that winter. And consequently, I think a lot of people stayed away from the theatre. And I wouldn't have thought that it did my reputation much good. What I enjoyed about it was the young people, the work that was feasible, the work that we did. And the stories, I mean, are all there. Ireland will never be short of stories.
And then you went to the heart of the big story of the time. You took yourself off to Belfast where you lived for...
Yes.
Lived for 5 years.
Absolutely.
Why did you do that?
I have always been interested in what people believe and whether people believe. And I had a kind of a belief, or I had an instinct that people in society, even though they had to align themselves with one kind of Christian or un-Christian or Muslim or Hindu belief, were nevertheless always spiritual beings. And I formed the view that really all humans have a sense of the transcendent. Whether they call it God or whatever the hell they call it, doesn't matter. I've always believed that since I was a small child, I suppose, you know. Catholicism was what we all started with and then left because of the church's narrow dogmatic attitude to human life and its absence of any kind of compassionate or loving nature. Anyway, in Belfast, I studied anthropology. Well, I wouldn't say I studied it very much. I kind of acted around. I used to work with young people in the East and in the West, that is Ballymurphy and over in Shadolly Street, which was off the Newton Arts Road, young fellas. So I kind of got to know the insides of life there. And I'm always fascinated by that. Anyhow, I worked a bit with Des Wilson, who was a great, great, great man. He was a priest in Ballymurphy who had asked to retire in the early 70s. And he was immediately dumped and all his faculties were taken away from him. Goodbye any income, goodbye any, it didn't matter to me, because the people who lived around him loved him. And he had opened his house, or the house in which he lived, as a centre for people to come and learn, to come and truants from school. So I used to do bits of video and we all did theatre together. We had a people's theatre.
But those were the years when the conflict or the troubles were at their most intense. I mean, shootings, bombings,
yes, absolutely.
Manner of conflict, riots. Where or did you at any stage see an end or a way through it to a better time like is being enjoyed or experienced now?
This is interesting, I would have had a lot of time for people like Bernadette Devlin, who was a good old pal now. Des always felt there was a better way than the way the IRA had chosen, or the provisional IRA had chosen. It wasn't a sense that you, first of all, you weren't one of the players, although I must say I did see a rise in community activism in those days, which was remarkable. And it was during the proroguing of Stormont, when there was no Stormont, and community groups with intelligent, calm, careful, working leaders on both sides came together. You know, life bearable for people. Sadly, the minute Stormont came back, they were shoved to one side, dumped more or less, and the politicians came back over again. You see, there's an awful silliness about an awful lot of the life of politicians, and that is that they are in touch, of course, with constituents, but it's only in the role of what can I do for you? What do you want me to do for you? Do you know, I mean, it's not necessary.
Did you ever consider getting into politics yourself in the in the sense of putting your name before the people and standing for either a council, local corporation or a council or the Dáil?
No, I didn't. Although John Hume said to me at one time, go on now, you should do something. And I thought, look, I'm working away at the level that I'm working away at. It'll do me.
And then from Belfast and from the intensity of that urban setting, you found yourself, was it in Belmullet?
Oh, yes, that was great. I was working for Combat Poverty. And it was more or less the same kind of thing, working with local groups, seeing what kind of enterprise was going on locally among people who together could make something happen, just to support what people were themselves not able to really do. Belmullet was regarded as part of America in those days, you know. I mean, it was a miracle that they were able to survive at all. But there was a co-op. There were people with ideas. There were people with energy. And they got going and made things happen. We formed a women's cooperative of people who made quilts. A quilting group, and they came together. There were four or five different things that happened and that were supported. And I just went around the place and lived in various parts of Erris.
And then to Galway.
Stan was very much, of course, the
Sister
heart
Stan, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You and she, you struck up quite a friendship,
no, she's a great. She's a great woman. No, she is a great, steady, funny, able person with a lot of insights. I think what she did with Birch in Kilkenny was the start.
That was the bishop, was it?
Yes, Bishop Birch. He was a great, also, a bit like Willie Walsh. They had a sense of openness, you know, to people who were around the place, surviving somehow and managing.
Were they what you would have regarded as the acceptable face of the Catholic Church?
I never thought of them as that, but that is possible. Yeah. I wouldn't be on for churches generally, I'd have to admit. Mm. You know, I find that they are inclined to corrupt people.
Speaking of churchmen, you were described apparently or allegedly at one stage by Archbishop John Charles McQuaid of Dublin as mad, bad and dangerous. I mean, did that actually happen? And if so, what were the circumstances?
I was doing a programme with Newell O'Connor, who is a filmmaker from Kerry, great woman, with Dermot Ferriter. And in the course of her researches for that programme, she went back and looked at some of the RTE things. This was a programme about, you know, what had happened to us as a republic since we declared ourselves as such. And in this, she came across this thing which said, you know, I don't think I was the only one. I think they kept an eye. They had various spies around RTE at the time.
Was it something he wrote in a letter of complaint about you? Or, I mean, where did she find this record?
I don't know in what portion of the research that she was doing that she found this.
Did you take it as a compliment and say, yeah, he got it right?
Oh, not. Well, look, a calm and quiet person like me, how could he think such a thing?
Yes. Yeah. Back to Galway, where we're sitting now.
Yes, here we are.
What brought you to this town?
I wanted to study medicine.
You must have been pretty much in the realms of being a mature student at that stage,
absolutely,
were you?
There was apparently a thing in Galway which said if you had a PhD, you could study medicine. You could leap over the opening years or year and become a doctor. And I'd always been interested in healing anyway, one sort or another. I mean, not that I am in any sense a healer, no. So I came over here. I then discovered, of course, that you had to have studied physics, chemistry and biology at school before you could begin to even contemplate any of these things. And needless to remark, I, as a girl, had never, among the nuns of the Loreto people in Rathfarnham, ever studied physics, chemistry and biology. So that was that. I did study homeopathy for 4 years and I did study herbal medicine for a year. But, you know, that was as far as that went. I came over thinking, look, I was teaching in Rathmines. Well, call it teaching. I was appearing in front of students in Rathmines and we were exchanging views on various things.
This was part of the media studies course that
exactly.
You were instrumental in
exactly.
establishing.
Yeah. That's right, we did. And they were a great gang. They're still very much around and I'm very much in touch with them, which is great. Brian Dobson, Anne Casson, people who still work in RTE.
Donald Byrne might have been another one, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, and the current culture and arts correspondent.
Evelyn O'Rourke.
She was one as well. Look, they were bright, brilliant people and they're still around and still are bright and brilliant. There were great people teaching on it, Michael Morris and Patsy Murphy. And so I thought, look, I'm off now. I can do something else. Came and looked around and said to various, well, actually one man called Elmer Kavanagh, who was an estate agent. I want to live in a small place near the sea. Got to have water. And he showed me various places. And they were horrible. And eventually he said, well, there's a ruin by the sea down near Kinvara. Do you want to look at that? I said, absolutely. So the minute I saw it, I said, yes. It was an old cottage. That was it. So I've lived there ever since in great peace and comfort and happiness.
And activism. But with your homeopathy then, you took yourself off, was it to Zimbabwe?
Oh, yes. It wasn't with homeopathy. No, it was. I was interested and I can't remember. There must have been some good friend who said, here's somebody who might be useful. You can talk to her about things. And this was about disabled women. There was a project which a International Labour Office in Geneva was porting. It had some Norwegian money attached and it was to enable disabled women in Zimbabwe to become really more active in the society. So that was it. A woman called Lina Magama, who was polio victim and in a wheelchair and married and an architect, was the local person. So the two of us worked together. I flew around here and there on a bicycle in Harare and tried to contact all the educational and arts organisations and trade unions that engaged in any sense women. Mugabe was around. If you think Irish television was unusual and unified, my God, you should have seen in the 1990s. It was nothing except propaganda. It was pure, unadulterated, no frills propaganda. What Mugabe wanted to say was said, and that was it. Anyway, I had a lovely time. I met lots of really beautiful people and a culture that really was so open and warm-hearted and put upon in a million ways. Like, you know, most.
How long did you stay there?
6 weeks.
Back here in the west of Ireland, as I mentioned, you got involved in some campaigns, notably the famous Mullagh More campaign.
Oh, yes.
That was to set up an interpretative centre in the Burren.
Yes, it was a piece of madness on the part of the government. But there you are, things happen like that. They had decided, on foot of some study that they had got done by an Oxford group of people, to put interpretive centres all over the country. And the people in Wicklow had objected to that. So the next thing was, I discovered, good Lord, they're going to do one in the middle of the Burren. Good gracious me. Anyway, so we just got together. John O'Donoghue, the poet and priest and thinker, philosopher, he was very, very part of it. Emer Colleran, who was a wonderful microbiologist and teacher and professor. Cousin of mine, Cyril O'Carean. PJ Curtis, the great musical guru. And we all just got together and decided that we would take on this project. And sensibly, I think, we decided that we would go to law and challenge the government's ability, because they said they did not need planning permission. And so we went to law, and Declan Costello, I think, was in the chair in the courts, and it was proven that they did have to have, and that all of the prisons in Ireland and many of the other centres were illegal. So overnight, the government had to leap to and turn them all into legal entities. And that meant that the Clare County Council was in charge of the decision. And to have a public inquiry, which we did, it was held in a hotel in Ennis. We always felt there was no objection. We had absolutely no objection whatsoever to there being a centre. We felt that it was in the wrong place.
Michael D. Higgins, as Minister for Arts, Culture and the Gaeltacht, he appointed you as Chair of the Irish Film Board.
Indeed. That was lovely. I had great fun. I had a very good board. I had myself and Tracy Geraghty, and who came and worked with me then and went on to work with me afterwards on the cinema. Neil Jordan agreed to come on board. And I asked each of the board members, as a point of honour, that nobody would ever bring a project to the board during the time of their tenure. It meant that Neil could not look for money from the board while he was a member of the board. This, unfortunately, well, I wouldn't say unfortunately, anyway, this changed. And I said to Michael D, as far as I'm concerned, you can put the board wherever you like, but I am not going to move from Galway. So he just decided to put it in Galway. It wasn't, I had never kind of said you must. And I always felt that it ought to be here, and regret very much that it has reverted to Dublin. But some people had the stupid idea that nobody of calibre would work in Galway. Isn't this awful? Imagine. Could you believe that? I mean, people are silly.
What, when you look back on your time there, your period as chair, were you able to get much done?
We got a lot done. We started a big study of the training needs of the business here. Because for many years, films that came into Ardmore used their own technicians, and Irish technicians were very junior. So I said, we have got to get a training system. And we also did another study, which was to enable each of the state boards, you know, the great idea of semi-state boards in Ireland. There was on the board Cor Thráchtála, the IDA, Bord Fáilte, and there were a number of semi-state who had an interest in financing elements of film. And I asked them all to come together and form a small committee, which we did. And that, it seemed to me, did in fact enable things which eventually turned into tax breaks and all of that kind of stuff, you know, and support for the beginnings of companies through Enterprise Ireland now. Young people who are trying to start companies, particularly in the West, the Irish language obviously being one of the areas that was supported.
And T.G. Cahir was founded, or
Tina
G, as it started
G,
off,
it did.
Television.
Well, Bob Quinn, you see, would have been a forerunner and a pioneer of all of those things.
And it's almost 30 years. How do you think it's done? Do you think
wonderfully? I think it's done extraordinarily well. I think it's one of the great headlines of broadcasting in Ireland, actually.
Do you think it's done better than RTE in the last three decades?
I do.
Why?
It's more inventive. It's more imaginative. It's lighter. It can move with greater alacrity because of being perhaps a bit smaller and having a particular area. You know, I mean, It's like, I remember when Páraic O'Rahilly came down to start Raidin na Gaeilge. I think if you have an audience that you know, you're speaking the language that they speak, it makes things easier to communicate, even though they also have to suffer the indignities of programmes being broken up by ads.
You mentioned showing films and you mentioned the cinema, which brings us on to the Paulos, if I pronounce it correctly. That's a project which is in, I suppose, a state of maybe suspended animation as we speak.
At the moment, yes.
Tell me about that idea and why you were so ardent in promoting it.
In Galway, for years, unlike Dublin, who has its own systems of, you know, independent film screenings, there was nothing in Galway. If you wanted to see an unusual film, you had to go to Dublin, or you had to hopefully maybe see it later on the television. We had, therefore, in Galway, the Galway Film Society. And the Galway Film Society, every Monday or every Sunday or whatever the day of the week it was, went around and had screenings, 16mm, never 35mm because there wasn't the money. And then Access Television came along with the Irish Film Institute. And I thought, look, since we have the Galway Film Society, let's give it a proper home. It used to be in the university. It used to be in the Town Hall Theatre. It came and went and was all over the place. So let's find a home for it. And that was it. And it was the turn of the millennium and monies were going to be made available. And I went and I applied for a couple of million, and which I needed 2 million. I always needed 2 million and I got one. Anyway, we decided to look around and see where we could get the money to make it happen other than that. So we went to the Arts Council. We looked for 750,000. They turned us down at first because they felt the place we had chosen was out of town too far. So then we looked around and looked around and we had two or three different places. Tom DePuer, I had worked with when I was still doing a bit of teaching in college, the film and video course here. And Tom had done a bit of work on converting an idea. And we had the Cinemobile, which I had got the money to run a couple of years earlier.
Yeah, that's an interesting digression. So let's go there. Tell me about that.
Oh, listen, I always felt that Ireland were cinema-going people. Mm. But little by little in the small towns, there had been local cinemas in all of the small towns. And slowly but surely, they had closed. And I thought, oh, Lord. And I saw this place in France called Tutankhamion. They made mobile hospitals and all of that kind of stuff. And then they began to make mobile cinemas. And I thought, hello. And I managed to get $500,000 to have them build a cinema for us in Ireland when I was in the film board. And so they did. The idea was we would go to places that had had a cinema before.
The Paulos then. So you got it up and running. I mean, initially it was to cost 5.2 million, ultimately cost 9.5.
Well, it cost about 8. It cost about 8, really. Well, let us, I'm not going to fight about this. You have figures, I have figures, I have a history. Hopefully someday it might get properly told. I think that as an entity, it had a real possibility. The difficulty is Galway City Council allowed a alternative cinema to be built in Salthill, while
this is the Omniplex now, a commercial cinema.
Yeah, yes, it gave planning permission for that, and it went and was built in Salthill with easy access to parking of cars, which is not.
I know, but your thing was
problem.
Completely different. An art house cinema, a civic facility for people to see independent films. I mean,
exactly.
Not necessarily an overlap between the two.
No, but I was not running it. Element was running it, and at times, in order to be able to wash its face, it showed mainstream, semi-mainstream stuff as well. You know, if it had been able to stick to very independent, you know, group
but
or,
where we are
thing,
now,
it would have been fine.
Lydia,
yes.
Here Element have handed back their lease, even though they had it for 30 years. They say, look, they lost, I think, almost 2 million. It was going to cost them 250,000 a year just to keep it open. The council, I think, were the legal owners of it now. They've done a report. They said, look, something like 78% of the films had fewer than 100 people in a cinema for 320 or thereabouts. So in other words, for it to be viable, to wash its face in your phrase, they would need something like 32,000 more viewers per annum.
Yes.
And so it's now, I think, in a situation where the council is looking for expressions of interest.
Exactly.
So well, take it from there.
I two mean, things are
happening.
Are
you expressing interest?
Yes, we are expressing interest. A small group of us, Miriam Allen, who runs the FLA, the first project that we have in mind is to get it opened for the FLA, which is in July, and that is for the week. If we can do that, to begin with, it will show those elements of public funding, which we hope will come eventually on board, that it is workable. I'm not saying it has to be three screens all the time to film. We think it could perhaps have a mixed use, artistic use. What is possible is what we originally had intended, which is that the Upmost cinema always was intended to have a stage. And this would have enabled, you know, small performances, readings, one-man shows, two-man shows, musical events of that kind. Unfortunately, Element decided to take out the stage from that cinema, and consequently, it didn't make sense in the end. But I do believe that the reversion into a more multi-arts cultural entity is what will work and could work and hopefully will engage and will enable us to put forward a plan for keeping it open for the
What did you think when Pádraic Bránach, I think it was, the founder of Máquinas, described it as a bad idea from day one, a disaster and an embarrassment to the city? Now, you may laugh, but that must have been a wounding comment coming from somebody of his stature.
He has a view of his own to which he is completely entitled. It wouldn't be my view. It's rather negative, in my opinion. It has no opening in it to enable a new idea. Everybody has a view, and they're entitled to the view. And Pádraic expresses his very loud and clear, and I don't mind that.
To use a phrase that we often heard during the crash, we are where we are.
Yes.
Now, one person you're very much on side in your corner, you've Shuni Rahali, who is, she's got a strong background in accountancy, and indeed she worked in Ardmore.
She didn't work in Ardmore. She rescued Ardmore from
her well,
attention.
Can she do the same now for the Paulus?
Well, with others. With others. We are, you know, we're a fairly strong group. There are some young people engaged as well. So let's wait.
But at the end of the day, you need the money, don't you?
Of course. In the end of the day, you need the passion. You need the resilience and the commitment. That's what you need. You know, you'll find the money. You will. There are good people everywhere with the right ideas and a few bob maybe. You don't need a huge amount. You know, you really do not.
Like if Element Pictures, and they own the Lighthouse, I think they run the Lighthouse
they do,
in Dublin.
Indeed, yes,
if they couldn't make a go of it.
They have done a good job insofar as they were able. But I think perhaps they did not understand Galway. I think they thought that Galway was a suburb of Dublin, and it isn't.
Would you be concerned that one of those, or maybe more than one of those expressions of interest would be to take over the place and convert it into apartments or something like that?
Listen, why would you bother your head? They're going to build apartments on that street anyway. So there is already going to be housing. Listen, there are people who have been suggesting that it could be turned into a hospital ward. All I can say is people's imaginations are always to be supported.
You don't like the idea. You've never said, or you've said you have never had a career as such. So how do you describe, I mean, you've had in modern parlance, a portfolio of activities, it might be said.
There have been people who have been kind enough to employ me, and I have been happy enough to be resilient and to find bits of work here and there. And I'm still at it. I'm not earning a living at the moment. I am a state pensioner of high degree.
Well, indeed. And are you able to live on the state pension?
Yes, just about. It's tough enough. But it's grand. Listen, am I complaining? Not at all. No. It's fine. I regard it as generous. I remember my aunt who got for the first time years and years ago, these were two of my great aunts. One of them lived to be 94 and the other lived to be 99. She could not believe that the state was giving her 10 shillings a week. She said, I never earned this money. I can't take this money. Anyway, somebody had the good wit to say to her, listen, you have worked all your life as a farmer. Will you come on? So I accept this. I don't believe that I necessarily deserve it, but I'm very pleased that the state gives it to me.
Your sister, actually, that reminds me, your sister was married. Mary, I think it was married
Mary,
to
a
man who was once the Minister for Finance, George Colley.
George Colley,
who had the giving out of these vast resources, and he once made the fatal error. I think it was around the This Week programme on RT of describing campaigning on women's issues as well-heeled, articulate women.
Yes. That was my sister.
What did you have to say about that at the time?
Not at all. Well, I was never a follower of Fianna Fáil at any stage of my life. I would have been Labour Party. And so I loved George Colley. He was a very decent, good, bright, capable man. So, you know, he didn't have, let's say, the point of view that I would have had. I would have been provocative to somebody like him, I'd imagine. And I think he probably gave me a fool's pardon because I was working in RTE when he was the minister. And so I never paid much attention to it, and I don't think he did either. Mary was she was wonderful. It was a shocking, dreadful thing. He died when he was only 57. Suddenly, unexpectedly. She has 7 children. Oh, God, yes. What people go through is extraordinary. Anyway, she lived to be 95.
And on your own 90th birthday last year, you marked the occasion by doing a parachute jump. What got into you? I mean, were you just mad for publicity or what was the reason or thinking behind that?
I just thought it would be a lovely idea to do. And the other, no, really, the real thing was to raise a bit of money. And we did raise a bit of money for Médecins Sans Frontières.
I'm wondering, what remaining ambitions do you have apart from seeing the reopening of the Paulos?
I don't have any great ambitions. I need to raise a bit of money for an opera that we're going to do in Gort in September for the Lady Gregory Gathering. I'm one of the board of Tor Ballylee, which we, as a voluntary group of people, have on license from Fáil to Ireland. Eventually it's going to, I think, sometime this year, be turned over to the National Parks and Wildlife. And we will continue to run events there. That's, you know, things like readings and small drama. Anyway, Colm Tobin's opera, Lady Gregory in America, which is hilariously funny. So that's what I'm trying to raise the money to do.
So is there going to be another parachute jump to raise funds for that? You have to do something, I don't know, dive off the top tier of the diving board out there in Blackrock.
Oh, good ideas. These are all very good ideas. I think jumping rather than diving would be more my style. I do swim.
How did you find the experience actually of getting out?
Oh, lovely.
Did you, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely great. Listen, it's not a thing to be getting into a state or bother about.
You mentioned earlier, I'm not a healer, but can I suggest to you, Leela Doolan, you are a tonic.
Thank you very much, Sean. Lovely to be here.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.